Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Jonathan Birch, Associate Professor at the London School of Economics. His new book, The Philosophy of Social Evolution, is just out from Oxford University Press. It seems to go against evolutionary theory for an individual to give up its own chances at reproducing in order to increase the fitness of others. Yet social behavior is found throughout nature, from bacteria and social insects to wolves, whales, and of course human beings. So what makes self-sacrifice to any degree even possible, given that self-interested behavior is the default? In his new book, Birch critically examines the conceptual foundations of social evolution theory, considering debates about kin selection versus group selection, cultural as well as genetic transmissible bases of inheritance, and inclusive versus neighbor-modulated fitness. He also discusses the view of multicellular organisms as societies of cells and extends the concept of genetic relatedness to include cultural relatedness by means of common cultural traits. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Jonathan Birch. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie.
I'm glad to have you here to talk about your book, The Philosophy of Social Evolution. I was just thinking, I've done books on the philosophy of social ontology, you know, what objects are social and institutions, and which is a metaphysical thing. And then I've also done on social cognition, which is about, you know, how we understand the minds and behavior of others. And this is a whole different sort of aspect of the social, you might say, which is how we and, you know, across, you know, throughout the biological world, different forms of, in some way, cooperative behavior have developed through evolution.
And how social behavior evolves.
So this is, you know, and of course, the pressing question, one of the pressing questions today is, well, just has it really evolved all that much? It seems we're not quite as cooperative as we might be.
We're not as good as ants.
No. So before we get into the book itself, maybe you can say a bit about your background and how you came to write this book.
My background, I mean, my first degree was in natural sciences at the University of Cambridge, and then I moved in to history and philosophy of science from there. I mean, it's one of the great things about that course that there's a kind of history and philosophy of science unit that Peter Lipton was actually teaching, and he was a great inspiration to me, really sort of got me hooked on the subject. And this topic of social evolution, I sort of got into around, I think, about 10 years ago now, in about 2009. I think what, thinking back to what really drew me to it, There was a paper by David Queller and Joan Strassman published in that year, 2009. It was called Beyond Society, the Evolution of Organismality. And I had no idea what that term organismality was supposed to mean. I just found it very intriguing. And the basic thesis of that paper was that you can see the organism itself as being a kind of social phenomenon, that an organism like a human being, you know, made of countless cells, is a kind of society of individual cells. And I just found that idea so striking, and I'd never come across it before. I just wanted to know, you know, the history of it and the biology of it and the philosophy of it, and try and find out whether it worked or not. And then 10 years later, that is kind of one chapter of the book, The Multicellular Organism as a Social Phenomenon. And then, I mean, I was working on that stuff for about a year. And then in 2010, there was a great big controversy that was kicked off by a paper in Nature by Martin Novak, E.O. Wilson, the famous sort of insect biologist, mm-hmm. and Karina Tarnita, that was kind of challenging a great deal of the received wisdom about the evolution of cooperation. So that, I mean, that was really kind of crucial for me too, because it sort of felt like the rug was being pulled out from under my project, you know, because I just started on this project trying to make sense of the organism as a social phenomenon, as this product of social evolution, and learning about the basic principles of social evolution. And then those basic principles were being called into question. And so I was drawn into that controversy. And that's reflected in the book too. I mean, about half of it is about why social evolution is so controversial and what the controversies are. Mm-hmm. And then half of it is about trying to use ideas from social evolution theory to explain things they were never originally intended to explain, like, you know, where organisms actually come from in the first place.
Okay, so, well, that sets us up to look at the first part of the book, where you begin with the basic conceptual foundations, which, as you trace to W.D. Hamilton and his work. So maybe you can start us off by saying, first of all, what are the sorts of, when we're talking about cooperation, social behavior, you introduce Hamilton's own four-part scheme, right? Yeah. Social behavior is behavior that's either mutually beneficial, or it's somehow selfish, or it's altruistic, or spiteful. So could you give us an overview of Hamilton's approach?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the book gets quite abstract quite quickly, I suppose. But it's crucial here to remember that sort of in the background, it's real phenomena, real biological phenomena that we're trying to explain, real things going on in the natural world, where it seems as though, you know, on the face of it, you look at these things and you think the basic logic of evolution is being denied because you've got organisms doing things that don't seem to be promoting their own survival or their own reproduction, but seem to be promoting the survival and reproduction of some other organism. I mean, social insects are perhaps the best known example of that, where you have your so-called eusocial colonies with the queens and the workers. And the workers just seem to spend their entire lives raising the queen's larvae rather than reproducing themselves. And, you know, in some extreme cases, they do crazy things. They sort of turn themselves into giant storage sacks for food for the rest of the colony, sort of not even moving, just hanging off the roof. Sometimes there's a nice example that I rather like where ants, this is a species of ant in Brazil. They want to, you know, they're trying to defend the nest from predators. And so at night they seal the entrance of the nest, but it has to be sealed from the outside. So every night there's a small number of workers that go to the outside of the nest and seal it up from the outside. And they will die overnight in the cold nighttime temperatures. They'll never see the morning. They're sort of, reminds me of Captain Oates. They're kind of sacrificing their lives so that their sisters can survive. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, you know, biologists looked at examples like this from insects and other species and didn't really know how to reconcile this with the logic of evolutionary theory at all. You know, and you had sort of ideas of group selection and things like that, that, you know, they're doing it for the good of the group, they're doing it maybe even for the good of the species. There was no really sort of worked out theory right up until the 60s. And that's when W.D. Hamilton, you know, at that time in the early 60s, just a grad student in London, he was funded through LSE, but also kind of enrolled at UCL, was just kind of trying to work out the maths of all this and came up with the framework that the book is about, you know, the framework of kin selection theory or inclusive fitness theory for trying to make sense of it. And I mean, his framework is quite an abstract framework. And in a way, the first thing he does is sort of abstract away from the kind of biological details of particular cases of social behavior and comes up with this way of sort of classifying behaviors by the kinds of effects they have on the fitness or reproductive success of the organism that performs the behavior and the organism that's affected. So that's where this four-part schema comes from, where the mutually beneficial behaviors, you know, the ones that they boost the fitness of the organism that does the behavior, but they also boost the fitness of the recipient of the effect of the behavior. And then you've got selfish behaviors that harm some other organism but benefit the agent that performs them. And then you've got these very puzzling categories, you know, altruistic behavior, which for Hamilton, it's nothing to do with the psychological motivations of the behavior, but it's about a behavior that harms the organism that performs it, that reduces the fitness of that organism and boosts the fitness of some other one, like the ants, you know, raising the queen's larvae. And spiteful behaviors, which are behaviors that are arguably even more puzzling because the organism that performs the behavior is harmed and the recipient that's affected gets harmed as well.
Okay. So how far, let me just ask, you mentioned insects, obviously the social insects, but some of the interesting cases you talk about in the book, for example, the bubble net feeding of whales, where they create this cordon of air bubbles around a school of fish that the fish won't go through, and then they kind of all go in to feed, which is fascinating for somebody who is not aware of these things. But let me just, one of the things that it seems the sense of social behavior that we're talking about here is widespread. If we're talking about, you know, insects and whales and presumably also human beings
and
bacteria as well, right? And wolves and so on and so forth. And so one of the questions that occurred to me was, you know, we're talking about altruistic behavior, spiteful behavior, you know, selfish. We're using terms that, you know, appear at least to have some sort of psychological aspect, at least in the case of human beings. There are many people who will talk about social behavior and it's somehow considered qualitatively different, right? There's a moral dimension to it, or something like that. How does, you know, from the perspective of somebody doing social evolutionary theory, how are these kind of differences between, say, human moral behavior, you know, punishment, legal systems, and then, you know, bacteria and since insects, is there any discomfort in the way the concepts of social behavior are used across, you know, so widely, or is this just simply not an issue in the field?
There's potential there for confusion, right? I mean, you're using terms like altruistic and spiteful, where the ordinary meaning of these terms, you know, is rich with psychological connotations. Now, that altruism is in ordinary life, you know, it's behavior motivated by concern for others. And then in this area of science and social evolution research, those psychological connotations are completely stripped away. You know, and what you're left with is this purely behavioral notion where it's about the effects of the behavior, the consequences of the behavior for reproductive success. It's only because those psychological connotations are stripped away that you can then apply it to bacteria, insects, as well as whales, wolves, humans. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one shouldn't exaggerate the the extent of the similarity in the mechanisms, in the proximate or psychological mechanisms. But nevertheless, there is this kind of similarity at a different level of description. You know, that there's similarity at the level of doing things that harm your own fitness and benefit the fitness of someone else. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what is Hamilton's rule? I mean, that's kind of the, you know, it does, there's a lot of technical discussion in the book, but also you take the time to explain things for people who are not well versed in that. But Hamilton's rule itself is an important concept or part of the whole package. So could you explain the rule and then how you interpret it as more of an organizing framework than a rule?
Exactly. Yeah, it's an important idea, you know, for Hamilton, and an important idea in the book, you know, because I sort of argue that it provides this organizing framework for social evolution research. Yeah, so this is kind of Hamilton, Bill Hamilton, back in the 60s, still a graduate student, really had incredibly insightful ideas. I mean, there's almost no one else like him in the history of evolutionary biology, I think, except Darwin, of course, and arguably R.A. Fisher. Just the coming out of nowhere, these insights. And perhaps the single most important one is this idea that has come to be known as Hamilton's rule, you know, after Hamilton, which is a kind of, it's trying to capture a sort of fundamental condition describing the circumstances under which a social behavior will evolve by natural selection. And it basically says, well, the behavior will evolve when the benefits conferred on whoever's affected by that behavior, defined in a certain way, you know, defined in terms of the long-run consequences for their reproductive success, outweigh the costs that the actor incurs in performing that behavior. So it's a kind of cost-benefit weighing. But then the crucial insight is that to get that condition for when the behavior will be favored by selection, you have to weight the benefits by what Hamilton calls a coefficient of relatedness, which is a way of sort of quantifying how close the genetic relationship is between the actor who performs the behavior and the recipient who's affected. And it's capturing in this mathematically rigorous way the kind of insight that was expressed by J.B.S. Haldane in this kind of famous story about, he was in a pub with, it's John Maynard Smith who tells this story, that they were in a pub together in London, and someone asked Haldane, you know, under what conditions would you jump into a river to pull out someone drowning in it? And Haldane supposedly calculated on the back of an envelope for some minutes and said, well, I'd do it for two brothers or eight cousins. And it's this idea that whether the behavior will be selected or not, whether the gene will spread in the population, crucially depends on how closely related the recipient is to the actor. You know, so how likely it is that by performing that altruistic behavior, that behavior that helps them, you'll actually increase the representation of that gene in future populations. That's the insight Hamilton's rule is basically capturing.
Okay, and you kind of reinterpret it to some extent anyway, in response to some of the objections to it. One being that it's supposedly tautological. I mean, this was, I think, E.O. Wilson and other people push back against it. So can you explain that generalization
That's right, yeah. I mean, so Novak and Tarnito and Wilson in that paper from 2010 I mentioned make the claim that Hamilton's rule almost never holds. They say this is almost never a correct description of the conditions for evolution of social behavior. And it all depends on how the terms in the rule are defined, basically. That, you know, critics of Novak and Tarnito and Wilson have hit back at that, saying, you know, look, it's not true that it almost never holds. It's actually an incredibly general result, you know, that requires virtually no assumptions at all. But it all depends on how you define cost and benefit. And you need to define cost and benefit in a particular way for that to be true. You need to define it as a kind of, in a statistical way, you need to define the cost of a of a social behavior as kind of the fitness cost that is statistically associated with possessing the genes for that behavior. And you need to define benefit and relatedness in particular ways as well. And then the next sort of step in the debate is that the critics of Hamilton's rule, you know, at that point fire back and they say, well, you've generalized the meaning of cost and benefit and relatedness to such an extent, you know, that's been so generalized compared to its ordinary intuitive meaning, mm-hmm. that what you've now got is this kind of tautology that really sort of says nothing. If it's as general as the if it's so general that it covers every process of natural selection, no matter what the details they say, then it's not really saying anything about those processes and can't really play any explanatory role. Mm-hmm. But I reject that, you know, and I reject that by arguing for this claim that, you know, Hamilton's rule is really, its role has often been misunderstood. Its role is actually the role of what I call an organizing framework. It's not something that gives us a kind of complete explanation of how social behavior evolves. It's not something that settles all the questions we want to ask about social behavior, but it helps us sort of organize inquiry, helps us organize the kind of more detailed explanations that we're going to give.
And those are, like, you have direct versus indirect fitness explanations and then hybrid explanations, yeah. and then non-selective explanations. Could you explain those?
Yeah, well, that direct versus indirect fitness is kind of the crucial distinction Hamilton's rule gives us, because there are some social behaviors that require positive RB, where R is coefficient of relatedness and B is the benefit, because they impose some kind of cost on the actor. And then there are social behaviors that are not like that. They don't require positive RB to evolve because the actor actually benefits over the long run. And in fact, a lot of social behavior is really in that second category. You know, organisms do it because over the long run, it benefits them in terms of their direct reproductive output. It's just that you often have to wait a while for those consequences to come back. You know, cases of reciprocity are fundamentally like that, you know, where in vampire bats, for example, vampire bats will kind of share when they've got a blood meal, they feed on the blood of other things, they will share it with other bats in the group that have previously shared blood with them. So there's this reciprocity going on. But that reciprocity is really a way that brings benefits to the organism that performs the behavior over the long term. So in the end, the explanation for why that behavior evolves is a direct fitness explanation. It's not one that fundamentally relies on positive relatedness. And then you've got this other category, you know, social behavior, where the explanation really does fundamentally rely on there being some positive relatedness there. And a lot of, behaviors that are genuinely biologically altruistic, including the behaviors of worker insects in ant colonies and things like that, are in that category of things, I think, that have to be given a kind of indirect fitness explanation in terms of benefits that fall on relatives. And then you mentioned the other two categories. I mean, there's also this important category of hybrid explanations where you have both kinds of effects at work. You know, there's benefits falling on relatives, and there's also benefits coming back to the actor. So the trait basically evolves for two different reasons. And then you've got non-selective explanations. And I think this is an overlooked category, you know, and an overlooked role of Hamilton's rule is to tell us when we have to look for an explanation that's not selective. Because if RB does not outweigh C, if we find that RB is less than C, you know, benefits related by relatedness is less than cost, that tells us we then have to go and look for some explanation that is not appealing to natural selection, but is appealing to some other kind of evolutionary process. And that's a crucial part of the Hamilton's rule explanatory role as well.
Okay, so you mentioned the concept of kin selection and group selection, and one of Hamilton's innovations was the concept of kin, group selection had already existed in some way. Kin selection was the innovation. Mm. Can you explain these two and how they differ?
Well, I mean, that's the whole chapter of the book. Yeah. It's this strange debate, actually, where, you know, they originally seemed like very, very different ideas. As I said, you know, the idea of group selection really, I would say, predates the idea of kin selection as a kind of well-known mode of evolutionary explanation. Because before Hamilton, people were talking about trying to explain social behavior in terms of what it does for the good of the group. Now, and then Hamilton was deeply opposed to that. And indeed, it is just a very flawed way of thinking about evolution, because there's selection within groups, not just between them. Within group selection is usually stronger. So things, you know, don't generally evolve when they're for the good of the group. And Hamilton came along with this different way of explaining social behavior in terms of benefits falling on individuals who are your genetic relatives. So it's this kind of individualistic mode of explanation. But that was the 60s view, you know, different ideas, individualistic mode of explanation versus more of a kind of group mode. And then it all got a bit more complicated, you know, because starting with Hamilton and then other people picked up this idea, kin selection and group selection started to be seen as really being just different ways of describing the same idea. And it's kind of, it's not easy to see why that happened, but basically it's that, I mean, both ideas underwent a process of generalization. Mm-hmm. You know, you start off with this nice idea of kin selection's benefits falling on your close genetic relatives like brothers or cousins, and then it gets generalized. And people start to say, well, you know, they don't have to be brothers or cousins, you know, as long as there is a genetic correlation there of some kind, as long as they're sort of more closely genetically correlated with you than just a random organism in the population, then that's still kin selection in a broad sense of the word. And then at the same time, group selection was also being kind of reinvented and generalized by people like David Sloan Wilson, where they started to say, well, you know, the groups don't really have to be that kind of well-defined, really. It's enough if you have these so-called trait groups where you've got organisms interacting with each other and affecting each other's fitness. So even if the group is really quite loosely defined, even if it sort of comes and goes, doesn't persist over generations, we can still call that group selection. And in fact, those ideas became... In fact, group selection was kind of rebranded as multi-level selection around that time in the 70s. And those ideas became so generalized that people started to wonder whether they were even distinct. You know, and you get these equivalence results showing that really, in a sense, they're not distinct. The most general statements of the two views end up just basically saying the same thing.
But you think that they're different as causal processes.
Yeah, I think that's not the end of the story, because I think that that trend towards generalization of the two ideas to some extent led biologists to miss important differences, right? And in particular, there's a sense in which causality dropped out of the picture a bit from general theory. I mean, I think biologists carried on thinking about causality. You know, it wasn't as if they just suddenly dropped the entire concept of causality. But when it came to formulating general theory, they came to prefer statistical formalisms, you know, ideas like the price equation, Hamilton's rule, where causality wasn't really being explicitly represented anymore. And I think that sort of led to people arguing for these equivalence results while sort of missing the fact that they were glossing over some causal distinctions that were actually worth drawing. You know, and when you draw those distinctions, you can start to recover a kind of difference between kin selection and group selection, but it's not a sharp difference anymore. It's a more complicated thing than that.
Okay.
They become these broad overlapping categories. You know, so there's big region of overlap where you can just say that that is really kin group selection. You know, it's neither one nor the other, because you've got the paradigm features of both. You've got really well-defined groups competing and you've got close relatives interacting, you know, but, and you have cases that have neither of the features of both and cases that have the features of one, but not the other. So you end up with this space of possibilities. It's not a sharp distinction, but it's not true that there's no distinction to be drawn.
Okay. Good. So, I mean, So let me ask. I mean, you. I think we've already talked about the concept of inclusive fitness, right? Mm. By relatedness.
Yeah.
The second part of the book involves some of the extensions of these basic ideas.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's where I want to turn to now.
Yeah, it's probably the bolder part of the book.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's a number of different ones. One thing is the role of culture, right? I mean, that's a big one. You mentioned earlier that what had gotten you into this was the idea of a multicellular organism being thought of as a society of some sort.
Yeah.
Can you go back to that issue? That's the chapter that ended up being. What is your view now of that idea that had captured you so long ago?
Yeah, I still like the idea a lot, actually. I mean, I came to realize that it had this long history, and it was a big idea in 19th century biology. Almost as soon as biologists came to realize that all organisms were composed of cells, they immediately started to think, well, how autonomous are these cells? You know, is it actually the case that what we thought of as this single unified organism was really this kind of social thing, really this society of cells? It was an important idea for Haeckel, for example. And I think the idea is really due a revival. You know, it kind of dropped out of the picture in the 20th century in biology, but is undergoing a bit of a revival, and I think that's a good thing. I kind of think it's one perspective on the organism among many, right? And you don't have to think of organisms as societies. But for certain purposes, it's a very, very useful perspective, I think. And I think that particularly if you're trying to explain why there are multicellular organisms at all, you know, most life on Earth is unicellular. Single-celled organisms like bacteria, they seem to be having a good time. You know, they split in half every 20 minutes. They're reproducing very fast. They seem to be doing great in evolutionary terms. And it leaves you with this interesting puzzle about why it was ever advantageous for cells to get together and form multicellular organisms. I mean, we're used to thinking of ourselves as somehow the pinnacle of evolution, right? So, of course, inevitably everything led to us. It's really not like that. It's actually quite a puzzle to explain why there would be multicellular organisms at all, and why it couldn't just carry on being the case that all life on Earth was unicellular. And I feel like a social view of the organism helps a bit with that puzzle, you know, because it gets us thinking about the organism in the right way. You know, it becomes a question about cooperation and altruism. You know, why did some cells evolve to kind of altruistically dedicate their lives essentially to helping other cells to reproduce, which is what most of the cells in your body are doing.
Huh. So
only a very, very small number will ever have a chance of producing a new organism.
Right. Well, then what accounts for, I guess, the unity? I mean, this is not something you go into in the book, but what, you know, I mentioned that I have discussed some books on social ontology, and there, of course, one of the big issues is whether we should quantify over groups of people, right, as individuals themselves, sort of supra individuals, and so it seems like there's a number of different levels of conglomeration or cooperation, or I'm not sure exactly what would be the right concept.
Yeah,
where you can talk about the single cells, you can talk about bacterial colonies or ant colonies.
Yeah,
you can talk about an individual multicellular organism, and you can talk about an individual, a club or some very tightly knit group, maybe a cult or something. From your perspective, I mean, how would one? Are there tools in social evolutionary theory that would enable one to distinguish these, or are they really just kind of on a par in terms of social evolution?
You're thinking about groups of humans here.
Or, like, why not have a, you know, you have the wolf, who is the multicellular organism, but you also have the pack, right? And why not just, or flocks of birds are another good example.
Yeah.
You have each individual bird who is a multicellular organism, and we quantify over the birds.
Yeah.
But then the question is, well, why not quantify over the flock? Because it has all these coordinated behaviors and so forth.
That's right. I think when you're looking at insects, that is a great question to ask, because some insect colonies become so richly cooperative. You know, there's no opportunity really for a worker in a sort of advanced eusocial insect species to have any kind of life outside of the group. You know, it's committed to the group. It's got no other way of living. In those sorts of contexts, it can be very, very useful as a shift in perspective to think of the entire group as being the organism here. And those individual ants are really playing the same role that the cells in our body play in us. Now, I think you need a certain level of complexity for that to become a useful perspective. Right? So I'd say with wolf packs and flocks of birds, you know, the cooperation is too loose. It's too possible for an individual to sort of change group. And the division of labor within the group is not as defined. But when things get to extremes, like you see in insects, there is this gradual shift, and it, for many purposes, it can be more sensible to see the group as the organism, and not even a kind of superorganism. You sometimes hear this term superorganism in the context of insects, but I don't really like that term. I mean, you don't need to call it a superorganism. You can just say it's an organism. It's exactly the same thing as us. It's individual lower level units cooperating with each other very, very closely.
So would any human groups by those criteria count as individuals, on your view?
No, I don't think so. No, in that the amount of sort of disharmony and conflict within human groups, I think, is the overwhelming feature of them. I mean, it's about whether there are processes that really reliably stabilize cooperation and that allow it to ratchet up to ever more extreme degrees, to the point where an individual really can't have any existence outside of that group. And for whatever reason, it seems like maybe humans might have been at the early stage of that kind of transition. You know, it could have been the early stage of a transition to a higher level of individual. But it seems as though that transition has stalled, I think. We haven't got there, right? It seems as though human groups are never really such that an individual can have no existence outside of the group they're in. They're never really cooperative to the same extent as an ant colony. I mean, compared to chimpanzees, there's far more cooperation. But compared to ants, there's far more conflict.
And yet we do manage to have languages which require a great deal of cooperation, obviously.
Yes, mutually beneficial cooperation.
Yeah.
We struggle a bit with altruism, I think, in the biological sense of the term.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, part of it is that I think a lot of human evolution, you know, took place in small groups. Those groups were not composed, or may well not have been composed, of close genetic relatives. So human evolution is kind of, for the most part, cooperation between non-relatives. And it's really very challenging to have stable biological altruism between non-relatives. In the end, it's much, much easier to have stable cooperation that is mutually beneficial. And I think on the whole, that's what humans do. You know, we've been incredibly successful at developing ways of cooperating for our mutual benefit, including networks of reciprocity and things like that, which, as I said earlier, you know, can really be thought of as cooperating for mutual benefit in a broad sense. That's what we're very good at. You know, but when it comes to real biological altruism, sacrificing your own chances of survival and reproduction so that someone else can increase theirs, I would say I think that that most of that is directed at close genetic relatives. There are things we do for our own children, for example, that we probably wouldn't do for anyone else.
Which is kind of unfortunate in our situation now with global warming. There seems to be some big effects of this inability to cooperate.
That's right. Yeah, we suffer terribly from public goods problems, collective action problems, free rider problems. And this is unsurprising because we now live in these very, very large societies where these problems are rife and free riding is easy, particularly on things like carbon emissions. And we don't have that genetic relatedness that is there in insects and bacteria and among the cells of our own body to overcome that.
So we've been inching a bit towards another big topic, which is cultural relatedness or cultural transmission. So just to get into that aspect of the whole idea of social evolution, a lot of what we've been talking about so far, and certainly in Hamilton and classical so-called evolutionary theorists, it's all genetic. Two brothers are eight cousins, right?
Yeah.
It's not culture, and yet culture does play an important role in some way in terms of methods of inheritance. So could you introduce a bit of how culture enters into the whole idea of social evolution?
Yeah, I mean, this is important in humans, right? In understanding human evolution, quite possibly also important in some other species too, including perhaps cetaceans like whales and dolphins and other primates like chimpanzees, but overwhelmingly important in humans. Now, it's this recognition that humans have created a different kind of inheritance system. I mean, we have the genetic inheritance system, of course. We inherit traits from our biological parents genetically. But in addition, we're very, very good at sort of high fidelity, high bandwidth social learning skills, values, beliefs, ideas from each other. And this creates a different kind of inheritance system through which we can ask questions about social evolution and the spread of social behavior. And I think it's pretty plausible, actually, that cultural evolution is the major part of the story about the evolution of cooperation in humans. We talked a bit before about the fact that these groups of early humans may well not have been groups of close relatives due to the amount of migration between the groups. And that the role of genetic relatedness in stabilizing cooperation or altruism in those groups was very limited indeed. But a lot of the behavior, I think, a lot of the norms, a lot of the dispositions, including pro-social dispositions towards altruism, would have been and really still are culturally transmitted through social learning, from learning from each other. And that's creates a whole bunch of interesting puzzles, questions, challenges for social evolution theory. It's what the last chapter of the book is about.
There you introduce the concept of broad scope pro-social preferences. Could you explain that?
It's just it's my term for something that a lot of people in the social sciences, sort of evolutionary social sciences, think is the real puzzle about human behavior, that we have these dispositions to be pro-social in the sense that we'll kind of cooperate by default. We're prepared to incur at least small costs, perhaps not large costs, in return for no obvious opportunity for any gain, but to help others. And economic gains and things like that, people do experimental sort of public goods games and things like that. And they tend to find that at least a percentage of the population does not free ride, and the fact that we're not all free riders all of the time seems absolutely crucial to explaining how human society hangs together at all.
Yeah.
I mean, we said there are a lot of big free rider problems that might mean humanity doesn't last for very much longer. But the fact we've got to this stage at all is largely due to our ability to kind of manage these free rider problems and cooperate even when we could free ride. So there's this puzzle here for the evolutionary social sciences about why humans are pro-social when there's no opportunity for reciprocity, when you're not cooperating with relatives, when cooperation is costly, when there's no reputational benefit. And that puzzle is, I think, still an important challenge that none of the kind of well-known mechanisms for the evolution of cooperation fully address.
So the free, I mean, you mentioned free rider, right? How does free riding fit in? Is it just like, well, this is just, we can expect a certain amount of selfish behavior and it just differs between individuals and those that are less, less social in some defined sense. Those are the people who become the free riders. So are there any predictions or conceptual frameworks for understanding free riding as, you know, how free riding comes about, how it sticks around?
Free riding is the default, right? The default expectation.
Okay.
From a self-interested agent in a sort of public goods situation where, you know, if you you could reduce your personal carbon emissions, say, but it wouldn't really make any significant difference to the public good and it would be a significant cost to you. So the default expectation is that a self-interested agent wouldn't do it. And it's hard to kind of, it's hard to really say reliably how cooperative humans are, I think. You know, because there's, it's always possible to say that on the whole people do free ride. You know, but I think if everyone was a free rider all of the time in every social dilemma, then human societies wouldn't hang together at all. So in a way the puzzle is one about how human societies hang together at all, given that for it to hang together requires us to do things like voting and donating blood and volunteering and stuff like that, where, okay, not everyone does it, only a small percentage do it. But the fact that anyone does it at all is something that requires explanation.
In this same chapter on cultural selection, you distinguish between two types, and you put forward what you call a cultural relatedness hypothesis. Could you explain that?
Yeah, cultural relatedness hypothesis. Right. So one of the most popular, currently influential ideas in this general area of trying to explain pro-social behavior in humans is cultural group selection, where the thought is that, well, human populations, certainly in the distant past, and to some extent perhaps even now, are structured into groups. Those groups compete with each other. The groups are fairly internally homogenous in that you have these social norms that everyone in the group is expected to conform to. And the groups that have the more sort of cooperative norms end up spreading at the expense of the ones that have less cooperative norms. And then there's a certain irony in the popularity of that idea, I suppose, because we've seen that in the genetic case, group selection is the kind of the minority, the sort of controversial idea, and it's kin selection that is the more mainstream view. And group selection is often regarded by many biologists, even now, I mean, perhaps somewhat unfairly, as being really closely tied up with kind of woolly thinking about things evolving for the good of the group, the good of the species. And yet when you turn to cultural evolution theory, the situation is reversed. You know, group selection is a very popular idea there, cultural group selection. And really no one is talking about cultural kin selection or culture, you know, trying to apply some of those ideas from Hamilton to the case of cultural evolution. So that's what I do in the last chapter of the book. I sort of say, well, here's a framework for thinking about the cultural evolution of cooperation that is in the same spirit as Hamilton's, mm-hmm. and that is based on the idea that what will get favored by selection is social behaviors that satisfy a cultural version of Hamilton's rule, where the meanings of cost and benefit are the same, but the meaning of relatedness is now different because the inheritance system has changed. So the meaning of relatedness changes too. And it becomes, rather than being a measure of genetic correlation, becomes a measure of cultural correlation between the interacting agents.
So cultural kin selection would be, such things as your religious kin, co-religionists, same language group. Are these the sorts of things that you have in mind?
That's the sort of thing where it depends on the precise trait of interest. But the thought is that while there are various processes that cause some people to be, in a manner of speaking, your cultural relatives, where you might not know them as individuals, but due to the structure of the population, they're much more likely than average to share the cultural beliefs, values, or skills that you do. And then the nature of the process in question will depend on the particular trait you're interested in. So if the particular trait was a religious belief, a belief about a deity or something, then it would be religious processes, processes of grouping people by religion that would create these patterns. And it would be other members of the same religion that would be your cultural relatives with respect to that trait.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me just, one final question, and it kind of goes beyond what you've talked about in the book. I was thinking about the hierarchies in human society. And I think you do touch at one point on the evolution of hierarchy, because cooperation, of course, as such, doesn't have with it hierarchy. Could you say that? And kind of behind that question, of course, is the whole idea of social roles that themselves kind of create and maintain various hierarchies, at least in a human society, right? Which are pretty pressing issues these days.
Yeah.
So how does hierarchy? I mean, hierarchy doesn't seem to benefit anybody except for the people on top.
Yeah, the elites.
Yeah.
Mm. It's an interesting puzzle. I mean, a lot of Kim Sterowny's recent work is addressed at this puzzle, where it's generally thought that the Pleistocene, prior to about 12,000 years ago, human populations were structured into smallish groups. You'd have a sort of residential camp or band of maybe 25 to 100 individuals, and those bands would be relatively egalitarian. Not in the sense that everyone kind of had explicit egalitarian beliefs, but in the sense there'd be no real hierarchy of control in those groups. People would share food with each other, things like that. And then if that hypothesis is correct, then you've got some sort of transition that occurs about, 12,000 years ago, when humans go from hunter-gatherer foraging societies to kind of settled agrarian societies. You've got this puzzle about why that came along with hierarchy and the loss of forager egalitarianism, the loss of equality, the emergence of these elites that control the masses. It is an interesting puzzle because you might intuitively expect that that sort of arrangement would be destabilized by uprisings from the masses, and evidently that hasn't happened. One possible explanation that Kim has talked about is that, if you believe some of this cultural group selection stuff, if you believe that the populations were divided into these tribal groups almost that were constantly at war with each other, constantly fighting each other, then you have the basis for a hypothesis where, within the groups, it doesn't pay to... it's bad within groups to have this hierarchical structure, but it might help you in the between group competition if it's the case that having a hierarchical structure within the group somehow sort of improves your ability to win wars. Now, because you've got this central organization, central leadership, clear command hierarchies, things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a hypothesis. So don't know if I believe it or not, but
I was just going to ask if this is something you buy into or not.
It's I'm always skeptical of almost any hypothesis about human evolution that requires very sharply delineated group structure.
Uh-huh.
Because I think it's a very natural thing for us to assume that there was that kind of group structure, but I'm not convinced that it's borne out all that reliably by contemporary ethnography. I mean, I think often the reality in human populations is that the populations are very fluid, groups blur into each other, people have these shifting identities, someone can be part of more than one group. And I think people in the cultural evolution field often exaggerate the groupiness of human populations. They often reify groups. They make them more real than they actually are in the human case. That's my suspicion, I think.
Uh-huh. Huh. Well, it injects a bit of optimism, I think, to the idea of social change. Even if you have social, cultural kin select. I mean, the genetic. There's not much you can do about who your relatives are. And that's just kind of a given biological fact.
Yeah.
And that can't be changed. Once you add cultural evolution, cultural inheritance through social learning, there's an obvious sense in which that's much more, that is more fungible, but it's not clear the extent of how fungible it is. And when you suggest that groups are really not, they're not rigid in a way that you might, that people working in cultural evolution tend to reify them a bit more than is really justified. That appears to suggest that some of the adjustments to human cooperation and society and the organization are themselves fungible.
Could be. Well, certainly population structure in humans is incredibly fluid. When inheritance is cultural, inheritance itself becomes rather more fluid, rather more open-ended. It's very unclear. You're not constrained to just producing a small number of descendants who are very closely related to you. You can have cultural influence on a large scale. I do think there's a sort of bleak idea at the heart of social evolution theory, which is this idea that for an altruistic behavior to evolve, it fundamentally has to be the case that the benefits of that behavior fall on recipients who are more likely than average to share the transmissible basis of that behavior. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a familiar insight in the genetic case, and I also argue that it may extend over to the cultural case too, when the behavior is culturally inherited. And there's something a little bit bleak about that, because it suggests altruism, if it's to evolve by a process of selection, it will never be completely indiscriminate. It will never be completely impartial. Will never be kind of peace and love to all humans.
Right. Yeah. Oh, dear.
Well, I mean, it's just, I don't really talk in the book about the political implications,
don't.
The politics of this at all, because I tend to, I want to focus on the facts. I always think the political implications can always cut both ways. I mean, if we come to take the view that our evolved dispositions are really quite a severe constraint on moral progress and social progress. And you could argue that just means we should work all the harder to try and overcome those constraints by organizing society in a better way. You could even argue that if we find that to be the case, we should be trying to edit our own genomes to overcome some of the constraints our own genomes impose on us, maybe. But in any case, I think these ideas are kind of, they're politically ambivalent. Uh-huh. Almost whatever your political views, you can take these ideas and try and twist them to serve that view.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's why I don't really discuss it in the book.
Right. So, well, we're running out of time. So I do want to ask what projects are on the horizon for you. Are you following up this book with something related, or have you gone in a different
direction? Well, I'm mostly working on animal consciousness at the moment.
Uh-huh.
Animal sentience. Yeah, I mean, if I eventually write a book on that, and I hope I will, we can have a talk about that.
Yeah, well, that's up my alley for sure.
Yeah, I think it's a huge question and an exciting time, actually, for working on animal consciousness. I really feel as though there's people from different disciplines coming to it, including my discipline, philosophy, but also neuroscience, physiology, animal welfare science, psychology. People are really starting to say, let's have a go at that question. It's mm-hmm. one of the hardest questions in science, I think, trying to work out which animals are conscious and which are not. But I'm very excited about that at the moment.
Well, I would like to thank you again for joining us at New Books in Philosophy. And I look forward to reading more of your work on animal sentience.
Great. Yes, nice to talk to you.
Okay. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
You've been listening to my interview with Jonathan Birch, associate professor at the London School of Economics. We've been talking about his new book, The Philosophy of Social Evolution, which is just out from Oxford University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.